Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This past winter was warmer and drier in the Carolinas. Despite a few winter weather storms and some snow, we were 2 to 3 degrees above normal. Good news if you hate cold weather, but not so good when you consider the cause: climate change. In fact, last year was the 6th warmest on record, and the trend isn't just local, it is global. As we move into spring and towards summer, you may have noticed a more plentiful dusting of pollen, also due to warmer temperatures and a mild winter. So what does summer hold? What kind of hurricane season should we expect? To help us get answers to those questions and many more, we turn this hour to Dr. Andy Pershing, Director of Climate Science at Climate Central. That's an independent organization of leading scientists and journalists examining our changing climate. Good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here.
Dr. Jack Sheff is also here. He's an assistant professor of geography and earth sciences at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for being with us.
Great to be here.
And David Borax is here. He's WFAE's climate reporter. David, welcome back. Good to see you.
Hello, Mike.
So, Andy, let me start with you. The job at Climate Central, as I understand it, is to conduct research into climate change and to keep the public informed of key findings. It seems that almost every week we have a key finding being published by scientists about the climate around the world. And I think the last one that I heard about indicated, and maybe I heard it incorrectly, it was kind of shocking when I heard it, that we have about 1 year to start making major changes, or we're doomed, essentially. We'll reach the tipping point of no return. First of all, am I right about that? And if so, do you agree with it?
Well, I think there's always a lot more nuance in these situations. So what they're talking about is the changes that we would need to make in society that would allow us to limit carbon pollution to the point where we could limit global warming to 1.5 degrees C, which is the international target set through the Paris Climate Agreement. And so 1.5 degrees, which is about 0.2 degrees Celsius, it sounds like really small numbers, but it's actually a fairly big difference. That would be relative to where we are now. And the concern is that the more we exceed that 1.5 degree target, the more dangerous and the more difficult the world gets after that. So, bigger, badder storms, hotter, more intense heat waves, all of those things get harder and bigger the further we blow past 1.5 degrees. And so it's not that like if we don't do it now, the world is going to end, but it's like there's a real sense of urgency to try to get carbon pollution under control, to try to get our society moving in the right direction so that we can have a safer future.
Is there a point of no return?
Well, there's certainly worries that there are tipping points out there in the climate system where, if you get a certain level of warming that you get some kind of uncontrolled change in the climate system. Those are really, really hard to diagnose. We see those risks probably more in kind of these unconstrained warming scenarios towards the end of the century. But in the near term, it's not the point of no return language I really worry about, because I think it tends to make people want to just, crawl under a rock. But in reality, like the U.S. is making some really great progress. North Carolina was number 5 in solar power generation. So we're making really good progress in terms of like bringing on more renewable energy, reducing our emissions. But there's clearly just a lot more that we need to do.
For years, Jack, policymakers have pushed back on the idea of climate change and certainly the human connection to climate change, insisting that not all scientists agree with that prognosis. So let's put this to bed once and for all. Is there a scintilla of truth to that? Do most scientists agree? And do most scientists agree that humans are the main cause through their use of fossil fuels?
Yeah, I would say essentially everyone working in climate science agrees that that's the main reason that the planet has been warming up for the last 100 years, right? So the overall warming of planet Earth, right, is definitely because of all the greenhouse gases that we've put in our atmosphere over those last 100 years, trapping more heat in the planet. However, I should always emphasize, and I always emphasize when I talk about this to my students or to anyone else, that there's still natural ups and downs on top of that. So we still have warmer summers sometimes and cooler summers sometimes. We still have warmer winters sometimes and cooler winters sometimes. And that's just natural variability. That's just the natural ups and downs of the system. But what we're doing, right, with our greenhouse gas emissions is we're making all of those warmer, right? So when we have a cold winter, it's not as cold as it used to be. And when we have a warm winter these days, it's warmer than a warm winter used to be. So that's the part that we humans are doing by adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere.
So it's hard to talk. It's hard to talk about graphs on the radio because there's no picture. But if you imagine a graph with a line, a straight line that's going slightly up, getting taller and taller with each passing year, and then you overlay that with a jagged line graph that's going up and down over and under that line, the straight line is climate and the ups and downs are weather. Would that be accurate?
Exactly.
Okay. So years ago, the former Vice President Al Gore put out this film and did a tour, and I think he did a companion book to it called An Inconvenient Truth, and it was about climate change. And he was making all these prognostications of what was going to happen if we didn't do something soon. How many of the things that he talked about in that, Jack, have already taken place?
I last saw that movie when it came out, so I don't remember things that he talked about. Can you give me a couple examples of
No, I can't, because I don't remember it either.
Said in that movie. No, I honestly don't remember what Al Gore particularly said.
I don't remember, you know, what Al specifically was citing, although, you know, he tends to hew pretty closely to the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and the conditions that we've experienced this year were in the IPCC reports that came out in the 1990s. We're living in the climate that climate scientists in the 1980s predicted that we would be in if we stayed on the high CO2 trajectory, which we did. So, you know, the climate projections are actually really, really good. They're not going to get everything right. They can't tell you, you know, when the hurricanes are going to hit and exactly how many, but they are extraordinarily good at getting these large, especially large temperature trends right. And so we are living in a climate that was predicted, and we have the projections going forward of, you know, another 2 degrees or so Fahrenheit change in North Carolina, six degrees if CO2 doesn't get under control.
David, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to make an observation about you had said something earlier about it seems like every week there's a new report. And Jack and I have talked about this in interviews. Oftentimes, this information that's coming out is not new. As Andy says, a lot of this stuff has been in reports from the Intergovernmental Panel from the UN. It's been in NOAA reports from the US government and that sort of thing. But I think what's happening right now is there is a growing number of scientists, organizations, and journalists. I mean, I'm a full-time climate reporter here at WFAE. We never had that sort of thing before. We're all looking for ways to tell this story and to make sure we get people's attention. So I think that there's a lot more attention being paid for it.
The predictions of a drier, warmer winter in this region, David, proved to be true, and they were based, I'm sure, on the study of what is happening with the climate trends, etc. What are they talking about for the winter and for the summer and fall?
Well, as you mentioned, we did. The predictions came true. And just for people's information, you know, in the Carolinas, that meant that many cities were 2 to 3 degrees warmer on average over the winter. And that includes a cold period in January. We actually did get snow this year. But overall, if you look at the numbers, they are rising. And I think the same will be true in the summertime again this year. And, you know, it may not be the hottest summer ever. I can't predict that myself. Maybe Andy has some thoughts on that. But, you know, it might be one of the top 5 or top 10 warmest summers that we've ever had. And that's kind of the trend that we're in right now. So I think we need to be paying attention to that.
And Andy, are these going to be the fact that David just said this may be the warmest summer so far, is that just for this region or would that be a national phenomenon?
So one of the really interesting things, these seasonal projections have both the fact that we have extra CO2 that tends to like push everything just a little bit warmer, but then you also bring in for the seasonal projections the kind of the state of the global climate, which the big driver is ocean temperatures. And so we're currently in a weak La Nina phase, which means cool water along the equatorial Pacific. And so that changes the position of the Gulf Stream. It changes the weather patterns. And that's been a big reason why, why this winter was warmer in the southeast. It's why we expect this winter the spring to be warmer also in the southeast.
We have these two phenomena out in the Pacific, La Nina and El Nino. And Jack, maybe you could explain the difference, because I know for a while we were in an El Nino many years ago, and now we're in a La Nina effect. What's the difference?
Right. Well, they're sort of opposites of each other. So in El Nino, the boy, right, that's when the waters in the equatorial Pacific Ocean, as Andy alluded to there, are much warmer than normal. And so that alters weather patterns around the world in one way. And then a La Nina is the opposite. The girl, that's when the waters in the equatorial Pacific Ocean are a lot colder than normal. And that would have almost the opposite effects on global weather. And the effects are different from place to place. But here in the Southeast, usually El Nino, the boy, often leads to a little bit of a cooler and wetter winter, whereas La Nina, the girl, often leads to a little bit of a warmer and drier winter. But again, that's going to be different if you go to a different part of the world.
And that's out in the West. And I know that weather, for the most part, moves west to east. Storms start in the west and move east. So that means, what is the effect of the changes in the temperature of the Gulf Stream mean for Europe and England and other places east of us?
Right, so it's fairly similar. So when the tropical Atlantic is warmer than normal, which can often be really for decades at a time, the tropical Atlantic Ocean, places like the Gulf Stream, can be warmer than trend, right? Europe often tends to have a little bit, warmer summers and springs during that time. And then, at times when the tropical Atlantic's a little bit cooler than normal, then Europe and even parts of Africa could be a little bit cooler than normal as well. But those also affect our own hurricane season here in North America, which is maybe why they're a little bit more of immediate interest here as well.
When we talk about climate change and global warming, Andy, people will point to the fact that, well, Charlotte had several inches of snow last winter. That doesn't happen when the weather gets warmer. And that is true, I suppose. But the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration points out that we have not had more than a foot of yearly snowfall in 15 years, and that used to happen at least twice in each decade. So how do we know that's climate change at work and not just some sort of bug in the long cycle of weather?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the interesting things is that climate change becomes more apparent the longer the time scale you look at, or the bigger the spatial scale. So if you're talking about any particular day, climate change is not going to have a big driver on that. There are some ways that we can start to see what the climate effect is on daily weather now. But for the most part, day to day is just a lot of randomness. And so a snowy day is just random. But when you look over a season, right, and when you look at a season over many years, that's where you start to see the climate change trend come into play. So the things that would tell us that this is not part of a natural cycle are the fact that, well, everywhere is getting warmer, especially if you look at it averaged over the year. The things that are going to tell us it's more likely climate change is that we see big parts of the country moving in the same direction over the same time periods. It's like the fact that we're seeing this kind of pressure over the whole planet, over the whole country, that's really what gives us a lot of evidence that this is related to a global pattern and not just some kind of local bug in the system.
And although we don't often believe our eyes anymore, because the pictures are out there on TV, we see these horrible fires in the West and the stronger storms in the Southeast and horrible flooding in Europe, all of which is due to climate change, we still don't want to believe it. We'll come back and talk more about what the summer may hold and what climate change may hold if we don't get a handle on it in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. We're talking about climate change and what to expect this summer as we warm up, because we just experienced a warmer and drier winter than normal. We're talking about all this with Dr. Andy Pershing, Director of Climate Science at Climate Central. Dr. Jack Sheff is an Assistant Professor of Geography and Earth Science at UNC Charlotte. And David Borax is WFAE's climate reporter. And David, you wanted to make a quick comment about blaming or not blaming climate for individual weather events.
Yeah, that's right. As Andy was speaking, it reminded me that one of the things that climate reporters like me and my colleagues have to think about is, and we get asked this a lot, oh, was that storm caused by climate change, or is this weather event caused by climate change? And we need to be really careful about that. You know, we can't necessarily say that this particular event was caused by the weather, but we can put it into the context, as Andy mentioned, of what's been happening. But there is an emerging field of what they call attribution science, where scientists are actually doing studies about very specific weather events, like, for example, the heat wave last year in the Pacific Northwest. And there is science now so that we can actually say that the reason that it was so hot in the Northwest was climate change. And so I think you'll start to hear more and more reports coming out from both scientists and journalists like me actually doing that. But we do still need to be careful.
And scientists have said, Andy, that the Southeast is experiencing climate change. The North Carolina Climate Office says that definitively. So aside from the warmer, drier winter that we just experienced, how will that manifest itself in the summer months? I know humidity is something we don't really concern ourselves with much in the winter, but it is a factor in the summer.
It certainly is. And, you know, we have two big parts of the global warming story. One is that it makes the planet warmer, right? So we're generally more likely to get warmer conditions, but a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. And so that means humidity goes up. And so we are seeing an increase not only in just higher temperatures, but also in these kind of hot, sticky days. Which are the days that can be very dangerous, right? Humans, we keep cool. We've evolved to keep cool by sweating. And when it's really damp out, we don't do that very effectively. And so it gets, we get hot, and that can be very, very dangerous, especially for people with underlying health conditions or people who might not have access to air conditioning.
Yeah. Jack, I know that aside from being a geography and earth science professor at UNC Charlotte, you concentrate in climate change, water cycle, atmospheric circulation as well. And state climate officials talk about expectations of more extreme heat waves, more hurricanes, increased hurricanes, sea level rise, which we've talked about on this program many times. But it also points to changes in rainfall, but those changes seem less certain than the other ones I just spoke of. Why?
So I think it's part of it is just it's harder to predict rainfall than temperature. And we see that even with the weather forecast, right? With the weather forecasters will mess up the rainfall forecast far more often than the temperature forecast. I think just rainfall is just, it's more localized. It happens faster, it dissipates faster. It's something that's a very local phenomenon, whereas warmer than normal or cooler than normal conditions can persist over a very large portion of the country or the world for a long period of time, right? Rainfall usually just sort of comes and goes. So it's hard for people to understand rainfall. And so it's also a little bit hard for our computer models to really get predictions of future rainfall, right, that are reliable. And that's especially true in summer when our rainfall is mostly driven by thunderstorms. So our climate models are very good at understanding future temperatures. They're not so good at forecasting future thunderstorms in a future warm climate. So we have a lot of uncertainty about what climate change is going to do to summer rainfall, even though we're very confident that it's going to warm summer temperatures and make the weather more humid in summer.
Well, let me ask you this. If it's difficult to predict whether or not it will rain, particularly in a hotter, drier climate, why is it that we are experiencing or seem to be experiencing in many places rainfall that when it does rain, it comes down in feet, not inches?
Right. So I'm very glad you asked that, Mike. So that actually I omitted. That's maybe what we do understand better. So I think that we have a much better understanding that as the planet warms up, when it rains, it will rain harder. And that's exactly for the reason that Andy was just talking about, which is just the warmer that the air is, the more water vapor can be held in the air. And so then when it rains, the more water comes out of the air down onto us as rainfall. So certainly, as we warm up the planet, we're going to experience that when it rains, it's going to rain harder. And we can already see that in the data, right? It already rains harder when it rains these days than it did, say, 100 years ago. But in terms of the total rain over entire season, there's a lot more question marks about that, right? But I think the easier part is that, you know, Sandy's mentioned that you have mentioned, right, when it rains harder than it used to. And as we continue to warm up the planet, that'll continue to be the case. And that's in summer, that's in winter, that's in hurricanes, that's in ordinary storms, right? Pretty much every type of situation.
So climate is stealing from Morton Salt. When it rains, it pours. We've often spoken, David, on this program about, particularly with regard to North Carolina, about rising sea levels and what coastal areas are doing to prepare for what is thought to be inevitable. I'm curious about the rest of the state, because with climate change, with warmer, drier weather, winter, spring, summer, and fall, growing seasons change. What you can grow will change, and where you can grow it will change. So what preparations, if any, are being taken in the world of agriculture in North Carolina?
Well, I should say that across all of the North Carolina state government, there's now people in every department who are worrying about this. They all have somebody whose job it is to pay attention to climate change and ask how it's going to affect everything from road construction to agriculture. So we definitely are paying attention to that. One of the things that they're doing is in the Department of Agriculture is looking at this in geographically specific areas and asking what we need to do. There are aid programs available. There are experts now available that are going in and saying, you know, what do we need to do differently? There may be some areas that we have to pull back from, especially along the coastal areas and in the rivers that go into the ocean where the salt water is rising, mm-hmm. you know, because of sea level rise. So we're definitely putting money into it. I think there's even some projects that are being paid for with some of the infrastructure funding that's coming down. So.
Yeah, we talked about that a few weeks ago when you were on this program, when we were talking about sea level rise, how as the seas rise, the water table becomes infected with salt water, and also salt water is pushed up the estuaries and takes normally arable land and makes it unfarmable because salt kills vegetation. The coastal areas seem to, at least some of them, seem to have the outlines of a plan and even a timetable to execute a plan on protecting coastal areas from sea level rise. But what about the rest of our state and other states where climate change is going to affect growth patterns? Is there a timetable? Are they making plans for that? Because I know that in some areas, they're beginning to construct these giant, greenhouses, for lack of a better word, and they're growing plants indoors where they can control everything.
You know, we do have a state office of resiliency that is looking at this, and a lot of it comes down to the local level. And if your local government is not paying attention to this, then you're probably not very far along. And that would probably include a lot of the rural areas in North Carolina. So what the state is doing is trying to do a lot of education right now and preparedness. There is federal money out there, there's state money out there, but if you're county government doesn't have somebody who can write a grant application, then you're not going to benefit from that. So one of the things they're trying to do is to build those kinds of skills at the local level and to share the data that people need in order to do that. And it's happening piecemeal right now. I would not say that it's widespread across the state yet, but we're starting to get there.
Jack, yesterday, the Los Angeles, California area declared a water emergency, and they have forbidden outdoor watering except for one day a week. And I'm curious as to why they would even allow it then, because they immediately on television, right after they said that, they showed a shot of one of the lakes that provides most of the drinking water, and it's completely dry. I mean, there's no water in it at all. So to me, outdoor watering should stop completely if they want to continue drinking. But we live in an area that seems to be particularly blessed with an abundance of water. Do you see a threat to that if this climate change cycle continues in its upward trajectory?
So I'm not particularly pessimistic about that. I think we'll always be a place that has quite a lot of rain going forward, unless, suppose, right, there are a few of these computer models that maybe think that we could get less, but most of them predict that we would have about the same or more. So I'm not so concerned about that, but I'm much more concerned, again, about just summertime heat and humidity, like some of us have been talking about on this show. To me, in the North Carolina context, those are the things that really keep me up at night about climate change. is the hotter and more humid summers in the future and the effect on human health, and also sea level rise at the coast, we've been discussing as well. But in contrast to those concerns, I don't see as much a concern about, say, less rainfall or less water resources in North Carolina. That's generally not what computer models are projecting for the future of North Carolina, right? We should have quite a bit of water. We just might be very uncomfortably hot and humid in the summers. We may have sea level rise drowning our coastal communities.
Lovely. Andy, let's talk about hurricanes. I'm sorry, David, do you want to chime
just,
in?
Just a quick thought, which is that, you know, while climate change is an issue with our water and we need to watch that, the other major threat in our area, quite obviously, is population growth. And, you know, we got, 100 people a day moving here. You know, we could very well run into problems down the road because of that. And as we have seen, not in Mecklenburg County, but in some of the counties around Mecklenburg, mm-hmm. there are water resource issues and they're having to draw water from other basins and all sorts of things.
Yeah. So let's talk about hurricanes. Andy, we've dodged many bullets in the last many years along the Carolina coast in terms of getting direct hits from hurricanes. But what does this hurricane season hold? What are the predictions for what we might experience?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't believe the official predictions are out yet, but because it's a weak La Nina, it's probably my bet would be that the official predictions would come out with slightly below average to slightly below, because La Nina, because of the wind patterns, tends to suppress hurricanes. But that's kind of competing, that wind pattern is competing against an ocean pattern, where the ocean waters in the Gulf of Mexico, the ocean waters in the Central Atlantic are above normal. And so that makes it easier for hurricanes. That's the fuel that they need to get going. So, you know, we have both of these things that are kind of duking it out right now. And they duke it out on a seasonal basis. And that's where these seasonal projections come from. And then they duke it out on a week to week basis, which determines, you know, when, you know, weather storms form, how quickly they storm, how quickly they form, and then how big they get.
We haven't experienced here a Hurricane Hazel or Andrew or even Hugo in many years along the coast. And since the last time we did experience a direct hit like that, there has been significant development along the coastline, Andy. And I'm curious, as because we've been dodging all these bullets, have people become complacent? And if and when we do experience a direct hit, will people be surprised?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, one of the best quotes I've heard in the last year was that there's no such thing as a natural disaster. Every disaster has a very strong human component to it. So there's the natural hazard of the storm. How big is the storm? Where does it come? But the impact that it has, whether it's a disaster, is very much in our control. And so that comes down to, how do we get warnings and alerts to people? How do we make sure that people can get into a safe place so that we don't lose a lot of lives? And then there's the fact that, you know, what are our building codes? What are the development plans? And are we allowing people to build in areas where, you know, we're going to have to come bail them out in some way. And so that's certainly a concern all over the country. And I imagine David knows a lot more about the particulars in North Carolina.
David?
Yeah, I just would add in here that it's not just an issue for the coast with these storms. If you remember last year, we had major flooding in the mountains of North Carolina that was unprecedented in people's memories. And it was declared a disaster area. There's millions of dollars of federal aid now going in there. And there's a lot of talk about, how do we keep this from happening again? And one of the answers, as you guys have alluded to, is, you know, trying to decide that we will develop in different ways. So.
In 2021, Jack, it was the sixth warmest year on record. I think the fourth warmest since 1895. That doesn't just mean that air temperatures are warming and rising, but seawater temperatures are warming and rising as well. And that is leading, of course, to migrations of fish populations and to dying coral reefs and the melting of our polar regions. But warmer ocean water can also have an impact on our weather. Talk about that.
Right. So especially in summertime, right, because our weather is sort of derived off of the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico, right, the warming of those oceans are part of why our summers are warming up. So and especially why our summers are getting more humid as well, because our summertime humidity comes from off the Gulf of Mexico and off the Atlantic Ocean. So as those oceans warm up, right, our summer weather gets stickier, the dew points, how much humidity is in the air rises, and the temperatures get higher. And that, again, that's hazardous for human health, especially, again, for folks who are working outside or who don't have air conditioning. And then if I believe it was Andy who mentioned that's also the fuel for hurricanes. So if yes. The air gets moister because of those warming oceans, right? That's going to fuel stronger and rainier hurricanes as well.
So given the fact that we are witnessing dying coral reefs due to rising ocean temperatures, which lead to the changing salinity and or acidity of the water, I suppose, and also melting polar regions, does it surprise you that we haven't had more trouble with hurricanes?
I'm not really surprised by the behavior of hurricanes that we've seen at all. I think they're doing exactly what we would expect. They're somewhat stronger and dumping more rain on average than they were, say, 50 years ago. And that's exactly what we would think from a warming planet. Stronger hurricanes and rainier hurricanes. We don't necessarily have a long-term trend towards more hurricanes, even though we are in a phase right now with more hurricanes. There's no long-term trend towards more hurricanes. But again, we wouldn't necessarily expect climate change to create more hurricanes. Rather, it's stronger and rainier hurricanes. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
Andy, you've written several papers about all of this, and one of them is called The North Atlantic Ecosystem from Plankton to Whales, and it's about how species are impacted by climate change. Why should we be concerned about that?
Well, I think you should, you know, we depend on, you know, on the services of the planet, right, of the ecosystems that are around us. So if you are, you know, if you're living on the coast, you like to go to the coast and, you know, go fishing or swim in the water, right? Take advantage of the resources in that ecosystem. Ocean ecosystems have other services that they provide in terms of like helping to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, helping to produce the oxygen that we breathe. You know, on land, we look to ecosystems to provide, you know, nature for us, you know, air, clean water. All of these things are a service provided by ecosystems. And so the big challenge, one of the big challenges of climate change is that it's kind of bumping into all of the things that we do with ecosystems and manage in terms of how we manage them. And so the big concern is that one of my big concerns is that ecosystems could change much faster than I think we could potentially model them. And then some of those dependencies we don't see, and that could be very hard for us to predict. So you mentioned, you know, coral reefs. That's a really great example of an ecosystem that has a very strong tipping point, where if coral reefs are exposed to water temperatures that are above what those reefs have experienced in the past, then the coral bleaches and the ecosystem goes very quickly into a very different state. We're seeing those same kind of ecosystem transitions in the West with wildfire.
So let's talk, when we come back from the break, let's talk about how all of this has actually been affecting each of us, people listening to us this morning, because we're in the middle of allergy season and a lot of people are suffering. We'll talk about that in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the climate and climate change and its impact on us with Dr. Andy Pershing, Director of Climate Science at Climate Central, Dr. Jack Sheff, Assistant Professor of Geography and Earth Science at UNC Charlotte, and David Borax, our climate reporter here at WFAE News. Anybody who lives in Charlotte, David, knows about pollen season. Most people are affected by this, and they seem to be getting longer, perhaps more frequent. Maybe we're reacting to things differently, perhaps in the spring or fall, than we used to, and we've noticed that because we go through Kleenex like there's no tomorrow. All of this connected to climate change, David?
Well, I think, we were talking earlier about the warm winter, and that absolutely has an effect on the growing season. And I think that's a major driving factor here. And I'm no biologist, so I can't explain the science behind all of this to you, but it does seem like we are all experiencing this. Maybe it's stretching the pollen season out a bit because of different growing seasons for different kinds of plants. But, it seems that people are also getting a little more educated about it. Well, I'm allergic to this kind of pollen and it's out now. And I think there's pollen forecasting from the National Weather Service that we get now. So it's really interesting.
Jack, you're shaking your head. I know Andy wants to jump in here too.
Oh, no, I just wanted to add, I think that's David nailed it there, right? That the longer growing season is important and also greater awareness. But I just want to add one other factor into the mix, which is that one effect of having more CO2 in the air, that it makes it a little bit easier on plants to grow, right? It's not, doesn't automatically mean there's going to be more plant growth. In a lot of places, the fact that there's more CO2 in the air is sort of allowing plants to use less water, which sort of makes it a little bit easier for them to grow. And that sounds great. But unfortunately, it's sort of the weeds and ragweed and a lot of noxious invasive plants that particularly benefit from that. And so we sort of have this overgrowth in the Southeast of plants of all kinds, especially fast growing invasive weeds. And that's right. Partly because of the higher CO2 in the air as well. And I believe that is also partly contributing to this.
Andy.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Okay. There have been a number of really interesting studies, right, that show that the more CO2 that's in the atmosphere, the more pollen the plants produce, especially ragweed and some of the grass and tree pollen that people are really allergic to. So it's both the longer warming longer growing season, which is almost a month longer in the Southeast now than it was in the 1970s. And it's the fact that we have just more, you know, more fuel in the system for the plants to produce more pollen. So it's kind of a double whammy, a longer season and a more intense season.
Yeah, I don't really suffer from spring allergies, but I have noticed that the trees are budding out and things are blooming sooner than ever. And the experts say that pollen season used to kick off in this area around St. Patrick's Day, which is March 17th. Now it happens on Valentine's Day, which is February, I think, the 14th. And it isn't just itchy eyes and bothersome sneezing that people are suffering through. Scientists say that pollen-induced respiratory allergy affects up to 30% of the world's population and can lead to a large economic loss because of medical expenditures, missed work, and school days. David, do you know if doctors or medical facilities are reporting that in this area?
I don't know the answer to that, okay. But I think I am friends with a lot of allergy sufferers, and I have asthma myself, and I can tell you that it does affect me at this time of year. I actually have to take additional medication, not just for the daily symptoms, but for breathing, and that's something that, you know, the rest of the year is not such a big deal, so...
And that leads us to this. People are experiencing this now for the first time ever. I mean, they're really beginning to notice. It's hard to ignore the pollen season. It's difficult to ignore the major fires out west and the flooding elsewhere. And until that became an all-the-time event, it was easy to ignore. But now, according to a new CBS News poll, nearly half of Americans say the area in which they live has experienced more extreme weather-related events in recent years. A recent Gallup poll reveals 1 in 3 Americans have been personally affected by extreme weather in the last 2 years. And all of this has led most of Americans, more than 60%, to be more concerned about climate change. In fact, Andy, you say that Yale University reports 71% of people in this state think global warming is happening. Now that people are catching on, will this speed the plow somewhat?
Well, I think it's really interesting, and I think it's so different how people actually think about climate change and how it gets discussed, especially kind of in our public and political discourse, where, you know, in 71% of folks in North Carolina think that global warming is happening. 72% of people in North Carolina want to see carbon dioxide regulated, right? They're asking for that. They want to see the governor and the government at all levels doing more about climate change. There's a strong majority that wants to see that action. And I think one of the big gaps is that only 34% of people talk about it, right? Or hear about it in the media. So that's why I think, you know, the work that David is doing is so important, because this is our new world, right? This is just a part of our lives now. And so we need to understand what that means. What does it mean that we live in a warmer, wetter planet? What does it mean that we have the potential for bigger storms and sea level rise? And what is it that we can do about it? It's very much the national conversation, yet I think we're really blocked. And the conversation that people want to have is not the conversation that I think we're having.
And why is that?
I mean, this is so challenging, right? I mean, it's just like everything else in our society. It's been so, it's become so politicized, and you know, who you are, where you live, it's become part of your identity. Where, you know, this is your reality. Like, everybody experiences temperature and heat and rainfall in the same way. These are all bad things that are happening. And so it's just really baffling to me that it's become so politicized.
David?
Yeah, I just was going to add, you know, when you ask people about it, they say, yeah, it definitely is happening and it's caused by humans. When you get policymakers in a room to discuss it, everything changes. And suddenly all of the existing structures, the status quo, kind of drives the day. And even though we know that this is an issue for us, it's really hard for us to talk about how we should do things differently. I will say that in the last few years, we've seen major changes in North Carolina. We did have legislation last fall, an energy reform bill that made North Carolina one of the first states in the country to actually write into law our goals for reducing carbon emissions from the energy sector, you know, by 70% by 2030 and eliminating them by 2050. And in a lot of other states, those goals are much less formal. But in North Carolina, we are committed by law to working on this. And the state regulators who oversee our energy utilities are spending this year working with all kinds of stakeholders to draft a plan for getting us there. They have until December 31st, and that's going to come pretty fast. And I just spent the past few days at an energy conference where everybody was talking about this. So we're going to keep seeing.
What drove that change politically? Because it wasn't that long ago that the North Carolina legislature almost forbid people to talk along the coastlines about sea level rise caused by climate change. This seems like a reversal of that. What caused it?
I think what's happened is that there is a kind of a broad understanding that climate change is happening and that the humans are causing it, and that the energy sector in North Carolina has a role to play in that. And it's time for us to modernize our energy system. They were discussing that. A bill came up last summer that made a lot of changes, but didn't really address that. And the outcry was so strong that they went back to the drawing board and they came up with a new bill that is, it's a compromise, but I think it helps that we have a Democratic governor who's committed to this and who is working with the Republican-controlled legislature and the big utility Duke Energy. And everybody is talking together about it. And, you know, nobody got what they wanted in that House Bill 951 last year, but it did get us a little farther down the road.
Well, we certainly want to phase out coal-fired power plants, and that is being done slowly but surely, and replacing it with renewables, et cetera, and natural gas, and nuclear, and water, et cetera. But isn't it still true, David, that the bulk of the emissions that lead to climate change are coming from tailpipes, from automobiles and other vehicles?
Transportation is one of the major causes, one of the top two nationwide and in North Carolina as well. And
so why hasn't there been a bigger shift or more incentives given toward the electrification of transportation?
And that's a question for the policymakers. I mean, in North Carolina, we do not have any kind of, to speak of, any kind of local incentives for electric vehicles. The only thing that you can get in North Carolina is the federal tax rebate, which may expire in a couple of years. And there's lots of talk about whether we get to keep that or not. But incentives definitely work. And, they're trying to do another incentive is to expand the charger network. And there's lots of federal money coming into the state right now to do that. We definitely need to get more chargers out there to address people's concerns about not being able to get from point A to point B on a charge. And so there are things happening, but I don't think in the Southeast, we have the same kind of incentives that they have in, for example, California, where electric vehicle adoption is way higher.
So I'm not going to ask you this question, David, because you're a journalist and you have to maintain.
I do.
What's the word I'm looking for here? You can't be partisan. I'm going to ask the two scientists. Our system of government, at the federal level at least, is set up to be slow. By design. So things take place very slowly and deliberately, and now they don't seem to take place at all because compromise is a career killer for Democrats and Republicans. So this requires compromise. It requires discussion. It requires a will to change things and to step on some toes. Is it going to take the kind of trends that we're talking about where citizens are now saying, 71% of North Carolinians are now saying, yes, this is happening, and yes, it is affecting me. Is it going to take that to push policymakers toward making changes? I'm not sure which one of you would like to answer that.
I mean, I can start. I have to say, you know, one of the things that I take a lot of optimism from is just like David was talking about, how much energy there is at the state level. I think we all can look to Washington and think about, you know, 15 different ways that it's broken and why it's hard to get stuff through in Washington. But at the state level, all across the country, we're seeing really huge progress in a lot of these cases.
But states are states, and although we have borders between North and South Carolina and Tennessee and Virginia and Georgia, the air doesn't know anything about those borders. Climate doesn't know anything about those borders. So this is not a state issue. It isn't even a federal issue. It's a global issue. And how do we get everybody on the same page?
Well, I think, you know, globally, I think there's been a lot of progress, too. I think, you know, the latest Conference of Party agreements every year, like where if you're a committed environmentalist, you always come out of those a little bit disappointed. But if you step back, like the world is coming together and it is taking some concrete steps. There are big announcements about reducing methane emissions. You know, methane is a super pollutant in terms of global warming potential. So there's definitely some progress. I think the other thing that I take some optimism from is the young people. This is such a generational issue. I think it's really easy for folks who are currently in charge of the system, who tend to be older, who came up in a certain environment. They're not going to in some ways be capable of processing the event. And as that generation gets replaced by younger people, even among Republicans, young Republicans want to see action on climate change. So it's very much a generational divide right now.
Let me touch quickly again, Jack, on hurricanes, because the Colorado State University, which seems to be the epicenter of hurricane predictions for whatever reason, says that the 2022 Atlantic hurricane season will be above average, with the number of major hurricanes making landfall. Major hurricanes are those with wind speeds of 111 miles per hour to 157 miles per hour. Category 3 is at the low end of that, but that is where catastrophic hurricanes begin. And that does not talk about anything but wind speed. It doesn't talk about the amount of rainfall that will deluge an area. They say that this hurricane season will be about 130% of the average. Last year was 140%. I'm not sure what that means, but they also say that this season is exhibiting characteristics similar to 1996, 2001, 2008, 2011, 2017, and 2021. What does that tell you, and do you agree with it?
Yeah, I think I would broadly agree with their reasoning, and I think where they're coming from is something that Andy, I believe, mentioned just a few minutes ago in an earlier segment. Which is just that we're in a long period right now where the tropical Atlantic Ocean and the Caribbean Sea, where hurricanes are born, where they get their energy from, is running warm compared to trend. And that's been true since 1995 or so. So broadly, since the mid-90s, we've been in a period where our the source of our hurricane fuel, the tropical Atlantic, has been on the warm side. And so we've had a lot of hurricane activity generally since then. And this year should be no different. We should have compared to, say, the long term, compared to, say, the last 100 years, we really should be expecting to see more hurricanes than we would over that kind of period. Though those years that you mentioned were actually pretty typical for the last 25 years, right? Really, since the mid-90s, we've been in a period with very active hurricane activity in the Atlantic, just because the Atlantic has been running warm compared to the rest of the world, or compared to trend.
And the economics of this has become almost impossible to ignore, because we have more frequent fires which are destroying property, et cetera. Out west, for instance, 5 years ago, the National Guard, who helps fight firefighters, spent 14,000 personnel hours doing so. Last year, 170,000 hours fighting forest fires. The Department of Defense sees climate change as a national security issue. When you've got all these factors building, Andy, it seems like nobody is listening. How long can we ignore this?
Well, I think there are, well, I mean, we can't ignore it. And I think, you know, there definitely needs to be more work done. I do take a lot, like there is some really interesting progress. Like the fact that the Defense Department is on it is really noteworthy.
At some point, the moneyed interests will step in here and make changes. I'll bet you that they're going to have to. And with that, we'll have to leave it. Dr. Andy Pershing, Director of Climate Science at Climate Central. Dr. Jack Sheff, Assistant Professor of Geography and Earth Science at UNC Charlotte. And David Borax, our ongoing climate reporter here at WFAE. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.